speech and protest. I'm Dave Zirin. This has been a WPFW editorial.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This hour is the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, here at your Jazz and Justice radio station, thanking you for joining us, and thank you to those listeners who choose to support this indeed listener-supported station for more than 48 years. We passed that mark coming out of last month into this month, and it was due to your calling and giving us the financial wherewithal to continue. For that, I thank you. Today, we're going to take a look at the Black wealth gap in Washington, D.C. We'll explore the stark contrast of wealth between Black and non-Black residents in Washington, D.C. It's a gap that has persisted for generations. And there's a documentary that features interviews with residents, economists, historians, and other important stakeholders who are members of our community to provide a comprehensive view of this issue. In order to do that, Dr. Sabia Prince is joining us. She is an anthropologist, artist, writer, and filmmaker, and importantly, a native Washingtonian. She wrote and directed the recent documentary, Diminished Returns, The Black Wealth Gap in Washington, D.C., and also co-directed Berry Farm, Community, Land, and Justice in Washington, D.C. with Samuel George. Dr. Prince is president and senior researcher of Anthrodox LLC. It's a qualitative research firm and production company, and that firm utilizes anthropological data gathering methods to create stories in support of social justice. Dr. Prince, good morning and welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, David. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. You've been on the show at least two or three times before. People know you in the community as the board president of Empower DC, which has a program on, if I'm getting my days right, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. I'll make sure that's correct if I need to repeat it later in the broadcast. Lots going on. This documentary that I mentioned of yours, again, Diminished Returns, The Black Wealth Gap in Washington, D.C., has caught a lot of attention. First of all, congratulations for your notoriety in the D.C. Independent Film Festival. And even, I guess, more to your pleasure and to the pleasure of many who want to deal with important issues, the Washington Post, the Washington Informer, and other media have taken notice not only of the film, but the outgrowth of its observations. So this documentary didn't come out of an instant. It represents a long commitment of your work. How is it an expression of the work, and how does it fit into your mission and purpose?
Well, thanks so much again for having me and for that opening question. The film is undoubtedly a reflection of my love for DC. I've had the great honor to be able to gather ethnographic data, interview a whole assortment of Washingtonians, folks that have been here since the 1920s and 30s, you know, people who come here from other places. And, you know, our city is just a wonderful city. There are a wealth of stories that are waiting to be told, waiting to be uncovered, that expand just a wealth of topics and subtopics. So I've been very honored to play a small role, or whatever role I can play, in highlighting those stories and connecting them to each other, to other stories across the country, to our history, and particularly to structural factors that have posed barriers to African Americans as they attempt to make their way and realize the American dream. So it's been another tool for me to do that. And I've been very excited about it because it harkens back to my training and my studies as an undergraduate, where I actually studied audiovisual production and photographic composition as a young pup in Poughkeepsie, New York.
So with that being said, I take it that you want the documentary, the film, to be viewed and experienced as an immersive experience as well as a learning one. How long did it take to make the documentary?
People are surprised when I tell them that it took a year or slightly less than that. We're really, again, blessed to be able to have this experience. People sometimes take years and years to complete this kind of project, but we had very good support. I should mention, of course, at the outset that the film is executive produced by the IF Foundation and Temi Bennett, who was also on the production team. And so we had their full support economically to complete this project. And, you know, we just hit the ground running. Temi asked me to make the film. It took a couple of months for her to get the money into the budget. I worked up the concept, pulled the team together, and we went for it.
Okay. And then, well, you're not the first person to produce excellent documentaries from the disciplines of social science. A cute question for the moment. Mm-hmm. As an anthropologist, what do you want to get across in the study of presentation? I guess the simpler translation would be, what does anthropology offer us, particularly with this subject?
Well, you know, anthropology has some great characteristics. It has some problematic characteristics, and it also comes out of a problematic history of imperialism and colonialism and white supremacy. That said, the methodologies can be right on, and one of the things anthropologists purports to do is to have respect for the people that you are engaging with and to see things through their lens, right? To put yourself in their shoes, to immerse yourself, if you will, in their experiences. So that's a positive thing. You know, the question is, of course, what do you do with that? What are your motivations? What are your intentions around that? You know, we have this subgenre in the field called ethnographic film, where anthropologists turn their cameras onto the individuals that they were engaging with to gather ethnographic data, to do reports, to write articles, write chapters, write books, etc. Far too often that lens was of a supremacist way, looking at people as primitives, kind of objectifying them, freezing them in time, not looking at a broader history or a broader context. So a part of decolonizing anthropology. That's a lesson that comes from anthropologists of color. And that's the lens that I bring. I'm letting folks speak their truth. You know, what is your experience? I'm not going to rely on tropes about people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, et cetera. We want to look at context, right? But folks have the knowledge to speak on their own history and their own experiences, their own lives, and share their own viewpoints. And so I think that's some of the ways in which anthropology kind of overlaps here. It's a progressive way of doing ethnographic film, if you will. It's an immersive and a social justice-based way of doing ethnographic film.
Well, you mentioned the word progressive, and I know you to be a modest person personally, but I would say you're living or extending the legacy of Zora Neale Hurston. She was a writer, an artist, an anthropologist, and she did have documentary films about everyday Black folk.
I'm not going to fight you there. I mean, I'm honored to be mentioned in her name, and I really hadn't thought of things like that. But I would also say I'm sure there's other people that are also following in her footsteps as well.
All right. Well, to take the notion of progression in another direction, in the film, you have many, many different voices. It's very polyphonic. And those voices are, each and every one of them, I would dare say, are important. Can you just give people an idea of who's in the 45 minutes of your documentary?
Sure. You know, I guess we put folks into two categories, and I would refer to them as two overlapping categories, right? You have your experts, if you will, and then we have people whose stories we delve more deeply into. And I would consider them as experts as well. They're knowledgeable, they're smart, they know their city, and they are experts in their own experiences. But, you know, that's one organizing principle, if you will, to look at folks who are solely given commentary, including scholars like G. Derek Musgrove or Ray Wimbush, both historians / political science folks who can contextualize things for us very powerfully, as well as, you know, we have the stories of four individuals, Lisa Butler, who's a D.C. native. They're all D.C. natives, too. So it's really exciting to be able to put these stories together of folks who are from here, like Tony Lewis Jr., who a lot of folks know, Jocelyn Julian, whose family was displaced from Chevy Chase back in the 1930s, and a young entrepreneur, Courtney Borrell, who's also a nail technician. But honestly, I wish I had labeled her as an entrepreneur in the lower thirds, because she's an artist. She, you know, is a person who's always looking to improve the economic standing of herself and her family. She's hardworking. She's creative. You know, she's innovative. And, you know, and we just shine a really short, you know, 5 minutes or so, probably even less, on these folks' stories, just to let people know that these broader economic processes have individual impacts. And let's take a look at those individual impacts. Those are where the stories lay, and those can be very impactful. I'll say, as Temi Bennett has made very clear, that the IF Foundation has reports and they have data, but people don't necessarily migrate toward those. Telling these kind of stories, building these kind of narratives are ways to bring people into the story and engage with them.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned this last point. There's always this battle between nerdy folks like yours truly and the everyday people, as far as what do numbers and sometimes facts that are folded or contained in reports, what do they really tell us? And one of the simple truths that is displayed in the film is that U.S. Census data has demonstrated a wealth gap throughout our history, particularly in Washington, D.C. Since I have you with us, why is that data important? What does it tell us? What does it show? How do we interpret it?
Well, let's speak numerically. Of course, what's been going around is that number about 81 times that the white households in the DC metropolitan area have 81 times the wealth of the average African-American community. So that's a stat. That's a valuable stat. That's a very stark stat that translates into hundreds of thousands of dollars for one group of people and only a few thousand for another. So those kind of statistics are important, right? But honestly, what I think is even more valuable are the historical data so that we can, you know, what's happening here? Why are we talking about this and what's driving this? And a point that we strongly want to get across is that these are structural and historical factors, much more so than individual acts, because African Americans are very just, I'm going to speak in a general sense, we are, of course, a diverse group of people, but generally our history reflects a people who have worked very, very hard, have faced a lot of, you know, adversarial behaviors and structural barriers. They've pushed against them from the time that slavery has ended. They have faced lots of cycles of oppression. Each time there is some sort of a gain made, such as Reconstruction, such as, you know, the Civil Rights Act, such as having more Black politicians in power, there's a pushback there. So we continue to face these cycles, and yet we continue to fight. That gap, that racial wealth gap, is evidence of the inequality, whether it's the hundreds of years of enslavement that made you start way behind the, you know, the starting gate, right, for the race, whether it's Jim Crow, job discrimination, not having inheritances, redlining, all these myriad barriers, they have to be discussed and have be a part of this conversation about the wealth gap. Those are the data that accompany the statistical data, and they work together to explain a situation that is really not that complicated.
Well, it's not that complicated, but certain sectors of society, all sorts of different people, find it hard to accept. Give me a moment and allow me to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. The program is We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Most importantly, I always say the focus is on our subject and our guest at hand. We're talking about diminished returns, the Black wealth gap in Washington, D.C., with its writer and director, anthropologist Dr. Sabia Prince. And we're exploring certainly the issues of race, economics, gentrification, and life in the nation's capital. Thank you for joining us, and let's continue. This last point that you're making is a really important thread. You have combined what I guess would be called very human stories, facts, important statistics, the impacts of policy. But the question remains that why, especially as an anthropologist, I speak to you, how can we get people to understand this racial wealth gap if it has a long history? Basically, why is a large part of society resisting even dealing or engaging that history?
Well, you know, anti-Blackness is a powerful thing, David. I think we've learned that over the course of history. It's unique. And each form of prejudice, racism, you know, violence, whatever that may be, xenophobia, they all unique and they all need to be looked at, I think, as how they are similar and how they are different. Anti-Blackness is a unique force. It has prevented African Americans from getting reparations for being enslaved for over 250 years, followed by terrorism and heinous forms of discrimination. And other groups have received reparations as they should have, except for those who enslaved Black people. Those are groups that should not have received reparations, and yet they did. And we're also including here entire countries, like the country of France and like Britain. So I think these are the barriers are in our education system, and the system is obviously a location for tremendous power and tremendous transformation. And that's why it is under attack. Our history is powerful, as is the history of people of color, of women and other marginalized groups. It's not special. It's not ethnic cheerleading. It's not reverse racism. They are facts, right? And they need to be embedded into our educational system. And I guarantee if this was something that had been done dutifully and purposefully centuries ago, we wouldn't be having these conversations right now, and we wouldn't be having these problems. And yet here we are. And there's a reason why these alternate, I guess you would call them, forms of history, they're just the basic facts, are under attack because of the power that they have to transform our thinking and our behavior. So that is a key part of the context.
And to extend that context further, and not to spoil giving away much of your documentary, but I would say that you have a Dr. Raymond Winbush. Professor Winbush is known for research. He directs the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. And he points out that freedom has such a shorter lifespan, so to speak, than the span of what he calls slaveocracy. Pastor William Lamar of Metropolitan AME Church says that, you know, the constant historical image of Washington, D.C. is that of a peaceful place, but underneath there's an ocean of chaos. The alleged system of meritocracy is actually a bloody system. And so that just punctuates the point you just made.
It's powerful.
Once again,
contributions. Powerful contributions.
Pardon me?
Those are powerful contributions that these folks have made.
Yes, Natalie, they are.
Hopkinson, you know, just testifying to the truth and saying, you know, when you look at these facts, it's reassuring to know, okay, I'm not crazy. You know, I mean, the facts are speaking for themselves, but there's this gaslighting that occurs, right? And we're in a period now of extreme gaslighting. And we should all be able to recognize when people are spitting utter nonsense, to be able to push back and have the facts, you know, to be able to do so. And yeah, we've had some really dynamic people. Also, Tonya Wellens, who's a philanthropic leader in our community here locally. You know, just a great honor to be able to have these folks, to be able to share and let people know we have all kinds of leaders from the grassroots to the middle, up to the top, all skinfolk and not kinfolk. And I think we all know that by now.
Well, we're dealing with the realities of no way around it. Black folk being removed from neighborhoods in mass, almost in one short and distinct moment. And that comes about in many different ways, as your documentary illustrates. What are some of the more well-established locations or venues or neighborhoods that experience this problem?
The problem of Black dislocation is extensive in our city's history, David, and it's something that I continue to learn more about each and every year. I think by now, a lot of us very commonly know that Georgetown had a significant Black population. So did parts of Foggy Bottom that were referred to as the West End. Malcolm X Park had a multiracial but predominantly Black community within that area. Along the CNO Canal, there was a Black area. By Chain Bridge, there was a Black area. In the Tenley-Fort Reno area, Chevy Chase, D.C., going into Montgomery County, there were solid Black communities that left traces via cemeteries, et cetera. But I, of course, a lot of us know about Berry Farm. I was able to make a film on that subject based on something that I learned about through organizers and by organizing. As a native Washingtonian, I went to Bunker Hill Elementary and Ruth K. Webb. I went to Bertie Bacchus. Didn't learn any of this. I think we were able to highlight in our film the story of Jocelyn Julian's family, again, who lived where Lafayette Elementary School is, right there in a very predominantly white upper income area.
Yeah, that neighborhood was known as Dry Meadows.
Correct.
Initially, yeah. And that's another thing. We're doing this recall between the two of us for this interview, but people should know a lot of the names have been changed. So the erasure is just not merely physical. It's a matter of policy and social ethos. I'm sorry to say, but that's the reality.
You will get an argument from me.
Well, you know, also you mentioned her and there was a lot of activity around acknowledging this historical removal in Chevy Chase. And for listeners outside of the Washington, D.C. area, quick geography. The District of Columbia is a federal district, not a state. It's diamond-shaped, roughly speaking. Its adjoining neighbors are Maryland, Virginia, for the most part, and several rivers. But from 9 o'clock to 12 noon is a west part of town, often referred to as Ward 3, because that's the bulk of it. And within that ward, this is the area that we're talking about if you ever have an occasion to visit Washington, D.C. With that being said, we're close to break, so I will just mention one factor, and then when we come back, we'll mention another. The fact is that I want to just briefly acknowledge is that a number of white residents now in Chevy Chase wanted to have dialogue with the displaced black families who were there. And what happened in that case? What do you want us to know of those efforts?
Yes, I was not a part of those efforts. So I'm learning about them secondhand from the pastor. That's
William Lamar, yes.
Yes, Pastor Lamar. That I think what was reflected is a reflection of what I think about land acknowledgments that people do, you know, to indigenous folks, is that it's completely and utterly meaningless unless you're giving somebody something. People want what was taken from them. They don't want empty words. That's what they've been given for hundreds of years. So I believe, you know, my understanding is the people were saying, we don't want apologies. We're not here for apologies. Something happened to us. It was structural. It was transformative, and it led to downward mobility for their family and other forms of harm. And they want the harm addressed and redressed. And that is the ask. Maybe that's not the proper ask for the people that are currently living there, but it's a conversation that needs to be had with folks who are decision makers and who have control of resources ultimately.
Listeners, you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm your host for this hour, the program's We the People, and we're talking about the Black wealth gap in Washington, D.C. with Dr. Sabia Prince. She's an anthropologist, artist, writer, and filmmaker, and a native Washingtonian. Her latest documentary is the subject of our conversation. It's called Diminished Returns, the Black Wealth Gap in Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us for this first portion of the hour. I ask that you stay with us as is part of our duty and mission here at your Jazz and Justice radio station to give you public service announcements. We'll be back right after this break, and thank you for being with us. Stick with us, and we'll finish our discussion.
This Saturday, tens of thousands of people are converging on Washington, D.C. in a mass demonstration demanding the freedom of Mahmoud Khalil, Mamadou Tal, and all other student and faculty victims of repression who are being rounded up, imprisoned, expelled from their schools, and possibly deported simply for speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. The rally is our opportunity to raise our collective voices, demand our right to free speech, and stand with the suffering people of Palestine. On Saturday, April 5th, noon at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest. Details at marchforpalestine.org. If you're unable to participate in person, WPFW will air live coverage from noon until 4 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Let me say free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Dr. Sabia Prince is with us. We're talking about the Black wealth gap in Washington, D.C. And I know people are interested, since we've been referring to this documentary, how can people keep up with it? My understanding is sometime in the fall it'll be widely available, but what should they do to find out more, Dr. Prince?
Sure. Well, you can see the trailer at the IFF Foundation's website. That's IFFDN.org. They, again, are the funders for the project, and the executive producer, Tammy Bennett Esquire, is the CEO, the co-CEO of that foundation. And they have the rights, they own the rights to the film, and their intention is to have more screenings come fall and the winter of 2025. If you go to their website, which again is iffdn.org, you can go to their culture section. You'll see the trailer there, and you'll also see a little form you can fill out online letting them know about your interest in maybe seeing it or hosting it or whatever the case may be. So feel free to proceed there. I'm sure they will be showing the film at libraries and various community centers. We've already received requests from different organizations who want to show it. We've also received requests from WETA and WHUT to also air it on public television.
Fantastic. We left with several points at hand. Let me start out with this. The notion of policy, which is not devoid from history. For instance, political scientist and historian, actually I'm more historian than political science, forgive me, Derek Musgrove, points out that housing is critical for wealth transfer. And he cites, along with others, that government policies were very much against this notion regarding Black folk. Can you just give us your sense of overview as the filmmaker of how policy does impact this issue?
Well, I mean, we understand from the historical record that the GI Bill, for example, is a massive set of policies that built the white middle class. So you can kind of look at the facts there and understand that there were structural adjustments to society, not individual achievement or individual shortcomings, that led to the expansion of the white middle class, right? These are things that Black folk were not able to take advantage of. They weren't receiving the same benefits of the GI Bill, nor were they able to move into the neighborhoods which have the greater increase in equity because of racial discrimination and redlining. So that would be a policy immediately that comes to the fore, again, as it pertains to building white wealth while blocking African Americans from access to that same wealth. So you can go, there are many different ways to approach this. I like to keep things rather simple. If you note all the ways in which Black people were disadvantaged, all you have to do is say, let's stop, either stop doing that, or let's make repairs to the legacies that were left for that treatment.
So examples by way of the documentary, but also by each of us having some personal knowledge and curiosity into history, would be urban renewal projects from the 60s onward. The use both federally and state and locally of eminent domain, where governments make a decree and loosely put, capture a piece of property for an alleged higher purpose. We mentioned history. The Homestead Act of 1862 ignored First Nations people and was part of their erasure because the pretense was land was either not inhabited or underdeveloped. And that will often be the sub rosa, the below surface reasoning that is made against people of color, whether they're First Nations or brown people or black people or Asian derived people. I mentioned Derek Musgrove earlier. He talks about the reality that when things like racial covenants, which are replete, they're not concentrated in one area of one city, whether it's Washington or elsewhere, but when those things were gotten rid of, forbade by law, when they were off the books, real estate agents still operated on what he calls an autopilot. Yes. You know, once that impulse was introduced, it wasn't let go.
That's what it means for things to be structural, right? That's what it means when it's woven into the fabric of a society to the extent that people aren't even aware of it. And let's also include gentrification as, we think of it as a modern day impact. Frankly, it's been going on for quite a long time, but that's another way in which the inequality is manufactured and people get caught up into cycles because they're in areas that are not resourced. And the areas begin to decline to a point that they become affordable to outsiders who have capital. They are able to build it up, and then the folks who've been there for a long time get displaced. We can also talk about appraisals, which are a practice that is engaged in, it's really a legacy of redlining, if you will, that, the people that give value to your property take it, and because you're Black or because it's in a predominantly Black area, they devalue it. That undercuts the wealth that you're able to pass down to your descendants. And inheritances are a very key way in which wealth is accumulated, passed down. How do you accumulate enough money to give someone an inheritance in the first place? You have to be earning more than you need to spend for your daily existence, and or have very good investments, have equity that you're building in the form of your residential property or business commercial property that you may own. These are all structural factors. These are economic policies and practices that people actually learned from their parents and their grandparents. It positions them and gives them privilege. And so it's not about individual achievement or the lack thereof. They're imperfect people in all the different racial groups. So it's not magical what we see going on.
Yeah. And so if that's disrupted, there's no acculturation, my little nod to your discipline, doctor. There's no acculturation, within the family or within community clusters. And sadly, there's what's attached to that are moral judgments, which are unfair, oppressive, and quite frankly, even racist. So again, you can have something like the Fair Housing, the Housing Act of 1968, and it takes all the wrongful, structural, systemic policy problems off. Remains a practice because that the previous injections, plural, are still fighting against that, still fighting against doing right by everyone, all people. Let's talk a little bit about how personal this can get between persons and between groups. One of the pushbacks that's negative is that people feel personally attacked when they have to engage history and make a correction. But yet, I think this documentary overwhelmingly demonstrates that whether it's the softness of velvet gloves or crass policy or violence, malevolence is pervasive in our communities, malevolence in our society, malevolence and governance. let's take advantage of something. You're an anthropologist. Do you know of cases where things become dismantled? And I assume that that might be over a long period of time.
You mean structures of inequality being dismantled?
Well, the whole spirit or ethos of the malevolence. In other words, you have outright crass oppression that we've described, but you also then get an inset of values that people operate by. And here in America, here in the United States, that seems to be, granted, it's an interpreted point, but it seems to be a way of claiming some innocence or unknowingness, not bothering to really know or engage historical and systemic problems.
Yeah, I think the historical record shows us that we have the capacity to do better. There have been key periods in our country's history, I would say the 1870s, the 1960s and 70s. Dare I include the George Floyd, the post-George Floyd period. I don't know whether I'm accurate in doing so, but I think there have been periods where folks have come together with an understanding that certain things need to happen.
So a racial reckoning, so to speak.
Racial reckoning and a class reckoning, because it's important to remember that when African-American people fight for justice, everybody wins, right? So the late 1800s gave us advances in public school education across the country, right? Not just for Black people. The 1960s gave us progressive legislation for immigrants and for women, for religious minorities, for elders, and for the physically challenged. That's affirmative action, you know, was not just for racial minorities, but white women benefited, physically challenged people benefited. So you have this, you know, this dissipation of various achievement gaps, et cetera, born out of the activism of African-American people that affects and benefits everyone. You know, and then you have things like the Affordable Care Act and DEI, you know, that reach a number of different people. And then here comes the pushback, you know, here comes the backlash. You know, there's been a history of anything that benefits Black people, or as I think whatever that Pennsylvania senator called them, blah people. Maybe you'll remember his name. When asked about it, he wasn't going to do anything that's going to benefit Black people. And when asked about it, he said, I meant blah people. You know, that's the American way, not one anti-Blackness. It's there woven into the fabric. We've been fighting against it for centuries, and it's exhausting. But I think we chip away. And as some people say, I don't know whether I agree with this, that we're experiencing the last gasp, if you will, of white supremacy and predatory capitalism. I don't know if that's true, but I think there are increasing numbers of people that are thinking the right way, and they are poised to be able to bring them over to our side with the proper political education and education for all, that is a social justice and an education for liberation.
My timing may be poor, but I want to get to this point. Since we're talking about a phenomena of gentrification that represents, it speaks loudly and much of the politics of race here in the District of Columbia, but also in many places in this country. And one of the ways your work was taken up was a story in the Washington Post earlier this month about the graying of neighborhoods. Can you explain that, please?
I'm not familiar with that. That was related to my work, the graying of neighborhood?
Same. The houses were losing their distinctiveness
Okay.
throughout
I'm
the
sorry.
District of Columbia.
I apologize. I'm thinking about a medical older people. Yes.
Yes. I apologize. I'm not being a good interviewer here, but let's get to why were houses painted gray and duller earth tones? And more so, it's like it's a correlate. What is this a barometer of?
Yes. Well, you know, honestly, I don't know the symbolism of the color choice. I happen to, you know, unfortunately like that color choice, but I don't like what it represents. And I understand why some people don't like to see folks coming into the area and painting over their brick homes in the community and kind of changing.
Which are brighter colors for one thing, or natural brick. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know whether, you know, is it symbolic of a more of a modern or an industrial design ethos, if you will. Perhaps that's what it represents. But
and I also allow the interjection. It was the post extending your work. It wasn't that you proposed this construct.
Because it was a conversation. What I was trying to bring to the discussion was how long-term residents feel about their neighborhoods changing and how that relates to their sense of belonging and or alienation in neighborhoods that they've lived in. And we should also add, in addition to the paint color, but also adding additional stories and making homes taller than they once were, and how that blocks the views of people and how people feel a little more closed in, more claustrophobic, and how that affects their relationships to their environment. So that was my contribution to that. Yeah.
And again, listeners, you're listening to We the People. It's a program, a news magazine involving race, history, politics, and culture. One of the many programs that more than 40 to 50 some odd public affairs programmers who join music programmers, were 100 in total, here at your Jazz and Justice radio station, that's due to listeners like yourselves making it truly an entirely listener-supported station. You get good programming like at 1 p.m. today, Africa Now with host Moesa Mutale. It's part of our celebration of Women's History Month, International Women's Day that occurred over the weekend. My salute to all the women programmers who gave us a Saturday full of music, culture, and more. And that's because, again, listeners like yourself support the station. You hear women's voices often in the noontime hour. Don't forget the blues, the Wednesday edition brought to you by Clarence the Bluesman Turner on this very day. And for that support, I thank you. Dr. Prince, it's been a pleasure to have you. We're again talking to Dr. Sabia Prince, anthropologist and filmmaker. Her recent documentary, Diminished Returns, The Black Wealth Gap in Washington, D.C., has been the subject of our discussion. You know, I'm glad you balanced me out, Dr. Prince, because, you know, when you know me both on the air and off the air, it's history, policy. But some of your featured participants in the documentary talk about a big blocker, and that is the reality that the District of Columbia is a federal district. There's not a bill, a budget, or a policy that doesn't have to meet with the approval, and sadly, the adjustment or tinkering of Congress and ultimately falling on the president's desk. We don't have full representation. We don't have full governance. So we'll leave the remaining minutes to you and just say, statehood and reparations are important remedies. And is this very much part of the way forward?
Undoubtedly. Justice has to be served. Reality has to be grappled with. And there's no other way to move forward. As I stated, the enslavers received reparations when people of African descent were emancipated here in Washington, D.C. So reparations are a must, and there's some strong advocacy going on in our city currently around that issue. Statehood is also a must. We have to be in control of our budget. We have to make decisions and not be under the thumb of a federal government that is hostile toward its residents. So those are things that must happen. We have to undermine and eradicate anti-Blackness in policymaking. And these are the ways to move forward. And people have to organize. You know, that's the way that we get what we want, by coming together and speaking collectively. So I feel very strongly about that.
Dare I ask, you know, I'm mindful that you did a documentary about Barry Farms. You've done this documentary. Is there a way that you can tell us, particularly since you run an organization that's trying to bring the reality of research to bear in our everyday lives, what would be next for you?
That's a good question, David. I have some plans that I won't be showing all my cards. I do like telling stories. It's a part of what I do. And I have some things in the can that I'm looking for funding for. And I would really like to spend this final seconds, if I would, could, just bigging up the other folks on the team, because I didn't make this film by myself. So I had a tremendous director of photography, Ellie Walton, DC native, filmmaker, editor McGee McElvain, another DC native. Sharon Pendana was a researcher. She's a DC native. Sandra Ratley was a story consultant, DC native. And we also had, did I mention Sarah Schoenfeld? She was a historical director, if you will, the archivist for the project, made sure that we had our facts straight. She's a DC native. Carla Bussey did the animation, tremendous work with the graphics and like. And then Samuel George was our story consultant, and I co-directed the Barry Farm film with him. So team effort, teamwork makes for the dream work. And I really wouldn't be the person that I am without always including these folks.
Well, Dr. Sabia Prince, my thanks to you and to them, because you all demonstrate that people really do care about each other. They care about the communities that we're in. And here at WPFW, it's our goal, bit by bit, show by show, to build better communities, one broadcast at a time. So much thanks to you, and well wishes, wishing you all the best in all your endeavors. And I thank the listeners for joining us this hour. Please be sure that whether it's this program or any other program of WPFW, you tell a friend, spread the word. We need social connectivity as well as your financial support. And again, both in advance and as you give it, and even long afterwards, you will have grateful people like yours truly thanking you. Speaking of thanks, my thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer for the hour, and to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. Thank you for joining us. Perhaps again, we'll meet on the radio sometime in the near future. Take good care.
Slaves to the king, six new moons of the year. He pockets our blood and our sweat, leaves us to our tears. Moth, 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 lawmakers cry.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, and on April 6th, noon until 7:30 p.m., Words, Beats, and Life kicks it off with the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam. Family-friendly activities, art activations, food truck vendors, and performances will all happen in Franklin Park. Details at wblinc.org/WBLFest.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Deya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
This Saturday, tens of thousands of people are converging on Washington, D.C. in a mass demonstration demanding the freedom of Mahmoud Khalil, Mamadou Tal, and all other student and faculty victims of repression who are being rounded up, imprisoned, expelled from their schools, and possibly deported simply for speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. The rally is our opportunity to raise our collective voices, demand our right to free speech, and stand with the suffering people of Palestine. On Saturday, April 5th, noon at 3rd and Pennsylvania Avenue, Northwest. Details at marchforpalestine.org. If you're unable to participate in person, WPFW will air live coverage from noon until 4 p.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Let me say free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Palestine!
Free, free!
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Idols that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
Hey, this is Alvin Nedab, your host of Music Memories, and my co-host,
Deborah Nedab.
And guess what, Deborah?
What?
We're moving.
We're moving?
That's right. We're moving from Mondays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., to Saturdays, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m., starting next Saturday, March 22nd. And Deborah, guess what?
What?
We're going to still continue to play the best old school music of all time. So we just want you to be there. 89.3.
Hello, I'm Dave Zirin, host of WPFW's The Collision, with an editorial. Mahmoud Khalil, a student at Columbia University and a U.S. permanent resident, has been illegally detained by ICE for organizing against the U.S.-supported genocide in Palestine. in detaining Khalil, the Trump administration, the State Department, and the Department of Homeland Security have made clear that they are more than willing to violate constitutionally protected rights to punish those who speak out against them and Israel's war on the people of Gaza. This is a deeply alarming development. It is a march towards authoritarianism. It is a blatant encroachment on our democracy, and it places all of us in peril, especially members of the most vulnerable and marginalized communities in our country. In the words of Angela Davis, if they come for me in the morning,